From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the State House employee turned state rep who says she was fired after being sexually harassed on Beacon Hill.
We owe it to the public to do everything we can to make sure that the misdeeds of politicians or their staff are not being covered up by the abuse of non-disclosure agreements.
Also today, what's next for autonomous vehicles after a woman is killed by a self-driving Uber in Arizona?
The vehicle was a Volvo again. It was a self-driving vehicle. It was in the autonomous mode at the time.
Plus,
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Mark my words.
That's President Donald Trump talking about his wall. Amherst professor Ilan Stavins explores how walls divide nations, citizens, and individuals. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to start today with State Representative Diana DeSoglio. She was shut down after trying to speak out about how Beacon Hill handles sexual harassment cases. Now, DeSoglio represents Methuen, Lawrence, and Haverhill today. But back in 2011, she was a Beacon Hill aide for then-State Rep Paul Adams. DeSoglio was 27 at the time. Again, this is 2011. And then she got caught up in the Beacon Hill rumor mill, really false and vicious rumors about her and another state rep. And because of those rumors, people harassed her, they propositioned her, they created a generally hostile environment. DeSoglio was subsequently fired. Yes, the woman who was harassed got fired. She was offered a small severance package, but in order to receive it, DeSoglio was told that she had to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
I did not want to sign it at the time, and I actually remember struggling for days with the decision because I really was disturbed by the fact that I was being silenced. I had been silenced the entire time that I was working in the building, and I thought, you know, at least if I'm moving on now, I'll finally have an opportunity to address some of the things that have been being said. And, you know, let me be clear, I'm in politics, so people talk all the time. You know, my issue is with the fact that other people's chatter and other people's solicitations to me and other people's name-calling had led to my wrongful termination. And then I, instead of being able to discuss that and to talk about what was happening and to respond, I was told that I needed to be quiet.
Okay, so let me ask you, when you chose to share this story, to talk about it in the House last week, were you in violation of the terms of the NDA, or has it expired?
I was in complete violation of the terms.
Well, this brings us to the present, to 2018, to what I was referring to, something that happened last week. Remember, DeSoglio was a legislative aide back in 2011, but she's a state rep now. And last week, the Massachusetts House debated amendments to a bill designed to improve the treatment of sexual harassment victims at the State House itself. DeSoglio, on Thursday, rose to tell her story and to advocate for an amendment that would ban the use of NDAs on Beacon Hill. House Speaker Robert DeLeo had left the chamber just before DeSoglio began speaking, but as she did, she was interrupted repeatedly and even pulled aside once by House Speaker Pro Tem Pat Haddad. Here's one of those moments.
I tried to do my job, hoping it would eventually be over and that some other story would come up that was more interesting than mine. And that
Chair apologizes to the gentle lady at the microphone. Chair will be in a brief recess. Chair recognizes Ms. DeSoglio of Methuen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to continue to tell my story because it does pertain to the issue at hand.
Now, that brief recess was actually about a minute long. We trimmed down the silence of that. But what did she say to you when she pulled you over?
Speaker Pro Tem asked me to essentially get to the point and speak on the amendment.
The specific amendment and not tell your story?
She didn't directly ask me to stop telling my story, but she did tell me that she was going to have to gavel me if I didn't get to the point and start speaking on the amendment.
And what was your reaction to that?
That I was speaking on the amendment and that my story, my experience was imperative. It was imperative that I told my experience in order to explain why we needed to adopt the amendment.
This seems so utterly bizarre that we're talking about trying to fix a culture of tolerance for sexual harassment in Beacon Hill, and when a female representative tries to tell her story about how she had been silenced before, it seems as if you were being silenced all over again. I mean, is that too strong a reading?
I'm not concerned about, you know, the dynamics on the floor and how I was impacted by them. I am I've been working in this body for 6 years now, and you know, it's nothing new. But what I will say is that what concerned me the most is the message that was sent by what happened in the chamber that day. You know, the number one fear of people coming forward and telling what happened to them is first that people won't believe them. But it's second that they'll be retaliated against. And I think that, you know, in the membership, that House leadership didn't do anything to, you know, improve that situation and to encourage people to come forward, which was the intent of the legislation in the first place. And the legislation that we passed was a tremendous and great step in the right direction. And I'm very proud of the legislation that we passed. I think it will go a long way to help victims to feel that they can come forward and speak about what happened. But, you know, the political culture on Beacon Hill has a long way to go.
So can I ask you a little bit more about that? Because it does, some people reacting to what happened to you as just seeing the terrible irony of female colleagues of yours in the House maybe not supporting you in the way that others would like to see. I mean, can you blame them? Because it seems as if so much of a person's political career on Beacon Hill really depends on being in the good graces of leadership there. I mean, I'm thinking specifically House leadership with Speaker DeLeo.
Well, I can't comment on what others did that day, have done in the past, or continue to do. I think that that's something that's a question for the people that you have questions about. But what I can say is that, you know, I came forward not to seek vengeance on anybody. I said very clearly, I'm not looking for any money. I don't want a lawsuit here. Nobody's going to go to trial about this. But my concern is for the young men and women in that building that do not have my platform and may be experiencing the same thing or much worse, much, much worse than what I experienced. And they don't have the platform that I have to be able to address this. So it was imperative that I came forward and just said, hey, you know, this is something that in the past may have been mishandled, you know, not because of malintent or not because anybody was trying to mishandle it, but, you know, there wasn't a process in place back then. We've learned. We're moving forward. We're implementing a process. But as part of that process, we need to look at the use of NDAs.
Yeah. So I'm going to get back to that in a moment because it's really important. But one more point about what happened on Thursday, because most of your colleagues knew that you were going to speak about this, because Yvonne Abraham in The Globe had written an article last week about it. And that's why the noted absence in the chamber of Speaker DeLeo during your speech was so interesting. And in fact, we have a little bit more tape here. This is Representative Angelo Scascia during the same debate over the amendment that you were proposing about the use of NDAs. And again, Speaker DeLeo had handed the gavel to Pat Haddad, and Representative Scascia was calling out the speaker's absence.
Mr. Speaker, where are you? Come out. Come out of your office and cheer.
Chair apologizes to the gentleman at the microphone. He is not speaking on the amendment.
Oh, thank you, Madam Speaker, for telling me about that.
We're talking about leadership. We're talking about trying to effect a major culture change in Beacon Hill. I mean, what did you make of the fact that Speaker DeLeo wasn't in the chamber during all that?
Again, I can't speak to his actions.
But what did you think about it? I mean, yeah, I'm going to ask him if he agrees to in an interview, but...
Well, I'll be perfectly honest with you. It was no different than, you know, the norm. But I will say that I was so focused on trying to get to be able to speak and trying to be recognized on the House floor to talk about the importance of the amendment and the issue that I wanted to earn the support of my colleagues on, that it honestly didn't really faze me that the speaker was not in attendance on the House floor that day. That was, a side issue that wasn't my focus.
Yeah.
My focus was getting the attention on the issue to make sure that we had important provisions included in this bill during, you know, what I believe to be one of the only opportunities that we're going to be able to make these changes. It was very, very important to me that we talked about this, that we made sure that we heard all sides, and that, you know, we were able to move some of these important issues forward.
Now, about NDAs and the use of NDAs on Beacon Hill, Speaker DeLeo has said that since the 1st of January 2010, that there were 33 NDAs signed, but that none of them, he says, were to settle complaints or related to complaints about sexual harassment. Now, yours was signed on September 2011, so it would seem to include that. I mean, the speaker's saying that since there's no language in the NDA specifically about sexual harassment, that the NDAs don't apply to that.
And that's why I filed the amendment the way that I did. You know, there was some concern that victims might actually want to sign an NDA, and certainly we hear those concerns. My concern in not addressing the issue of NDAs across the board and only pertaining specifically to matters of sexual harassment, which was what the speaker's language had added in to my version of the bill with his own version of the bill that I drafted. My concern with that is that these documents don't specifically say what they are for, whether it be, you know, discrimination against somebody based on the color of their skin, a disability. We talk about the LGBTQ community. Whatever it is, that's not included within the language of these NDAs. So you wouldn't know whether it was sexual harassment, whether it was discrimination, or whether it was something else. You wouldn't know that. So it was very important to me to try to highlight that aspect of the issue.
I'm not sure of any NDA I've heard that's ever that specific. Like, it's more sort of general, like you can't talk about the terms of your termination. That kind of thing.
And that's why they're able to be used in such an abusive manner.
Which makes me wonder, I mean, that's why I feel like politics is being played here right now. You're a representative, and I know that maybe there's things you feel like you can and can't say. I'm speaking from the point of view of a citizen of the Commonwealth looking at what's going on Beacon Hill, and I'm saying, well, if the speaker wants to put in language in an amendment that says an NDA has to say specifically sexual harassment, well, literally none of them ever will, so what's the point?
So that was the issue that I kept trying to raise, but was not being recognized multiple times to be able to say. I did eventually get to say some of the points that I wanted to say, here's what I'll say is this, you know, to say that none exist is to say that I'm not telling the truth. And I think that that's problematic because what it says to other young men and women who are working in that building is that if they come forward, they might not be believed. Mm. I also offer this question, you know, if you say somebody was terminated wrongfully and you agree, which the speaker's office did, that my termination was wrongful.
Why have you signed an NDA at all?
Well, if it was wrongful, what was wrong about the termination if it's not what I'm saying, number one? And number two, why have only 33 people had to sign non-disclosure and non-disparagement agreements in order to get their severance pay when there have been many, many more people fired in the course of the last 9 years? You know, it's not part of the process that if you get fired, you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement immediately. That's not how the business goes there. And speaking of business, it was also said, you know, that non-disclosure agreements are just part of doing business. I fundamentally disagree with that statement on so many levels, but I'll just stick to one point right now. I just want to remind everybody, this is not a private business.
This is a public servant.
This is not a private business. People have disagreements about private contracts, and that's a completely different debate for another day. This is the people's business where public tax dollars are being used. We owe it to the public to do everything we can to make sure that the misdeeds of politicians or their staff are not being covered up by the abuse of non-disclosure agreements.
Well, State Representative Diana DeZoglio of Methuen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we should note that the House did pass its bill on improving the procedures for handling sexual harassment complaints at the State House. It includes an amendment that says the only time non-disclosure agreements can now be used is if they're requested by victims. We also put out several requests to hear from House Speaker Robert DeLeo. He couldn't join us today. His office, though, did send us a statement, which includes the following, quote, "We believe Representative DiSoglio's statements regarding the harassment she experienced in April 2011, and we are deeply troubled by them. No member, officer, or employee of the House of Representatives should be subjected to the sort of treatment described by Representative DiSoglio." However, DeLeo's statement also says, quote, "DiSoglio's attorney never raised the issue of sexual harassment or inappropriate conduct during the negotiations which led to her termination and severance agreement. While we understand why a victim of such harassment would fear disclosing it, we have to reject any assertion that we were aware of it prior to Thursday or that we sought to silence her and or to cover up any harassment with the 2011 agreement." Well, we look forward to speaking with the speaker on the program soon about this and many other issues. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've got a couple of big stories when it comes to social media and your data. The Federal Trade Commission announced today that it's launching a probe into Facebook's use of private information from users' profiles. Also, NPR is reporting that Facebook officials will appear before both House and Senate Judiciary Committees tomorrow. Plus, we've got news that Cambridge Analytica announced today that it has suspended CEO Alexander Nix. Now, all of this comes after the New York Times and the London Observer reported in a blockbuster set of investigations that Cambridge Analytica, a London-based data analytic firm, gathered information from over 50 million Facebook profiles without the permission of those users. And then the firm used the data they had collected to help target users for the Trump campaign in the 2016 presidential election. Cambridge Analytica has written in a statement that the company, quote, strongly denies the claims made by their work by the Times and other news organizations. But those claims come from a man named Christopher Wiley, the man who developed and executed the plan to harvest user data that Cambridge Analytica used. He told the UK's Channel 4 exactly how the company weaponized user information.
We spent almost $1 million doing this. It wasn't some tiny pilot project. It was the core of what Cambridge Analytica became. It allowed us to move into the hearts and minds of American voters in a way that had never been done before.
Now, this series of stories and investigations has, of course, reignited the debate over Facebook's use of user data, over user privacy, and concerns about exactly what motivates the company when it comes to how it uses or lets others use your data. Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the Boston Globe, brought up some of these issues in his column today, headlined Facebook's Mentality, Anything for a Buck, and Hiawatha joins us now. Hello there, Hiawatha.
Hello.
Okay.
Glad to be here.
Do you feel a little better now that we have the House and Senate Judiciary Committees talking to Facebook? We have Alexander Nix suspended from Cambridge Analytica. Do you think we're on the mend in terms of how Facebook lets companies use its data?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, the thing is, you have to remember, and let's be perfectly fair to Facebook, a lot of this is based on stuff that happened years ago. And I think that's very important to note. Facebook, back in the, like, around 2014 timeframe, had this really interesting setup where companies could actually not only get information about people, for example, a company could create an app, and people who use this app would give information about themselves. But that same app would allow the company to get information about the person's friends. And so they could end up scooping up gigantic amounts of information, millions and millions of people's information. Since 2015, Facebook stopped doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what's going on here is stuff that Facebook did years ago. And I think, in all fairness to the company, this has to be said. Another thing has to be said. Did you see what came out from a former member of the Obama campaign?
Yeah.
Did you read that story? It turns out that they were getting access to Facebook data in the 2012 election about literally everybody in the United States.
Right. They were amongst the first to really use that information
politically. That's right. We have to understand that the difference with what happened with Cambridge Analytica was that these guys got the information under false pretenses. They claimed that it was being used for academic research. But if you look in terms of what they were actually doing, they were doing the same thing that the Obama administration had been doing or the campaign had been doing back in 2012. So this is not a new thing.
Okay, so Hiawatha then, I mean, what's the problem?
Well, the big problem, I think, is that Facebook shouldn't be giving this kind of sensitive information to any of these guys. I think it's pretty ridiculous that they're handing out so much of our data to people for this purpose. And also, there is the larger issue of whether or not any one company can safely be entrusted with this much knowledge. I mean, if you think about it, these guys have files on literally one quarter of the world's population.
Yep.
There has never been a government on Earth that has known that much about that many people.
Yeah.
And they're not accountable for it.
Hiawatha, let me just jump in here. So for anyone who's an obsessive Radio Boston listener, they've probably heard me really rail about this in the past because, look, yeah, I'm not technophobic, but when it comes to the power that these companies wield because of the information that we are giving them, I've been extremely dubious about it for quite some time. And I have to say, I feel like we've arrived at a point that a lot of people have seen coming. But the question is, what to do about it? I mean, Facebook's entire business model revolves around the possession of this information. As you said, about 25% of the world's population. That's how
Absolutely.
They're making their money.
Absolutely. And it's really worrisome because, frankly, I'm worried about it, too, and I'm not sure what to do about it. The instinctive reaction of a lot of people is that the government has to do something. But what exactly? Obviously, I mean, some people say they should regulate Facebook, but I don't think I'd want that kind of information under the control of any government. And also, of course, whose data would they regulate? Facebook is an American company with huge amounts of information about people in France. Do we get to regulate that information, too? The regulatory challenges posed by a company like this are quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
But we have to rise to that, though, right? I mean, like,
yeah,
like many
I think
other
we're
major
going to have to.
Many other industries that touch everyone have been regulated by the federal government because we have collectively as a society decided that that's the only way to assure some sort of accountability.
Yeah, but the mouth flip, I'm going to turn it over on the flip side, though. What happens if you have a situation like what they're proposing to do in Europe, like in Germany, where they're basically saying, we're going to fine you millions of dollars if you don't take stuff off of this platform that we here consider hate speech, or if you don't delete something that might embarrass somebody about something they did 20 years ago, the so-called right to be forgotten. And in American context, we look at that and say that's a violation of individual liberty. And European countries are trying to impose that kind of value on an American company. And that's scary, too. It's a really worrisome problem. Do we want other countries requiring us to meet their standards, which in terms of speech and civil liberties are much lower than the American standard, which says, hey, almost anything goes. So how you regulate it without stepping on each of these landmines is something nobody's figured out
yet. I mean, maybe it's a process, right? I mean, like, that's what the courts are for. The federal government creates some laws, it gets pushed back, courts decide what's right, what works and what doesn't work. I don't think there's any quick fix here, but the idea that we can sort of just leave things to the wild west of Silicon Valley to make all the decisions doesn't leave me feeling terribly confident.
And I agree, and I think that's exactly right. And one of the most interesting things about this whole phenomenon is the fact that this has now become a growing scent right across the political spectrum. People on the left, people on the right. I mean, even people who are on the political right, who traditionally very, very reluctant to have the government regulate stuff. The conservative magazine National Review actually ran an article saying, let's treat Facebook and Google as public utilities and regulate them the way we used to regulate the phone company. That was a shocking article, but it shows
they're not
that
the first to say that, but they may be the first from that end of the political spectrum to say so.
Exactly. Everybody is starting to notice this. These guys have almost unchecked power over vast quantities of information. But it's worse, because here's the other thing you have to remember. It isn't just that they know everything about us. It's that they're the people who tell us what we need to know. When you go to get information, chances are, for many of us, the first places you go get it are Facebook and Google. All they have to do is change their software, and what you know about the world changes, because you'll never see the things they don't want you to see. They've got that power, and we got to figure out how to deal with it.
Well, Hiawatha Bray, are you going to delete your Facebook account? What are you going to do in the interim?
I'm thinking about it, and I'm writing about it right now. I don't think we should. I think actually people should have Facebook accounts. You should keep your own Facebook account, because the real issue isn't whether you have an account, it's what you put in it. If you are very selective in what you put in your Facebook account, having one is not a problem. And in fact, you probably should have one, because it keeps somebody else from creating a fake one in your name. But what you put in it, you should be very, very careful.
Well, just out of full disclosure, 3 years ago, I deleted my Facebook account, and I honestly felt entirely liberated. But
did you put it back?
A couple years after that, I did, but only I created a new one, a brand new one, like fresh and clean, only because it's a powerful organizing tool in a lot of sort of parents groups, for example, that I join organized through Facebook. So I create a new account. I only log in a couple of times a year and just check things out. I don't actually post anything, and I think that's a happy medium right now.
I think that's the way a lot of us are going to go. I mean, I'm basically saying to people, don't get rid of your Facebook account, but consider using it a lot less for a lot less sensitive stuff, or being less revealing about who you are and what you think on your Facebook account. But even that could have interesting consequences, because if fewer people use Facebook and the company makes less money, what does that do to the U.S. economy? This is one of the biggest sectors of the U.S. economy.
Yeah, but they would have to be millions and tens of millions of people before we saw that, deleting their Facebook.
Hey, if they keep this up, it's going to happen, because people are getting scared.
Yeah. Well, Hiawatha Bray, from now on, I'll just signal you via semaphores from the WBUR studios to the Boston Globe
signals.
Office.
Smoke signals.
Hiawatha Bray is technology reporter for the Boston Globe. It's always great to have you, Hiawatha. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, let's move on to another major tech story. Unfortunately, this one, too, has a slightly darker tone. And that's because a self-driving vehicle being tested by Uber hit and killed a pedestrian in Tempe, Arizona last weekend. 49-year-old Elaine Hertzberg is believed to be the first person ever killed by a fully self-driving car. Now, the car, which initial reports say did not slow down, was in autonomous mode at the time, though a safety driver was behind the wheel. The National Transportation Safety Board is working with police to investigate the incident, and the collision is, of course, renewing questions about the risks of allowing autonomous vehicles on local roads, also asking questions about the future of self-driving technology. Since Sunday, Uber has halted all testing of self-driving cars in Arizona. And in Boston, city officials have asked Newtonomy and Optimus Ride, two self-driving car companies that run tests in the Seaport, to hold off until they can undergo a safety review by the city. So let's talk about what all this means for the present and future of autonomous vehicles. And joining me now to do so is Brian Reamer, research scientist at MIT's Age Lab and associate director of the New England Transportation Center at MIT. Brian Reamer, it's good to have you back.
Welcome.
Also with us is Robin Chase, co-founder and former CEO of Zipcar, and also co-founder of Venium, a network company that moves huge amounts of data between vehicles and the cloud. Robin, it's great to have you back as well.
Hi.
So there's no such thing as a perfectly clean new technology. What happened in Arizona is a tragedy. It's a tragedy. Someone died. But also, I feel like it's not entirely unexpected. Like, this was bound to happen sooner or later, Brian?
Simple law of probability. The complexity in which we drive is immense. So it is the only question of how many miles, how many years, how many days until something went wrong in some way that we didn't prescribe beforehand. And what we see in Arizona to many degrees is a situation that we do not today fully understand, although the police chief in the area has issued a preliminary report. I think NTSB's investigation, which will most likely take months, is what we need to understand the depths of what happened. Mm. But as we drive and as we live and move from point A to point B across the city of Boston, Massachusetts, the country at large, the complexities and the amount of gray area that we drive in and that the human mind is capable of navigating through is immense.
Okay. So let me ask you, Robin, let me turn to you about that. Does that mean that have we let these tests of autonomous vehicles onto actual city streets, have we started those tests too early?
I want to declare at the age of 59, I've been in 4 car accidents in which people have died. So I care a lot about this issue. And I'm struck that over the last 2 years, we've had a 15% increase in traffic crashes in this country. Mm-hmm. And I'm a bicycle rider, as is my family, and you're constantly finding people who are not paying any attention at all right now. So when I think about this accident, which I want to say is terrible. What is our bar for self-driving cars? Do they need to drive better than we do? Or do they need to drive a little bit better than we do? Like, when do we start putting them on the roads? That'd be one question. And then the other is, I think we should do a lot of tests in labs, you know, virtually, on computers, in simulations. But at some point, you have to have real cars mm-hmm. on the street with people.
Well, so let me ask you both about that, because I do want to explore sort of what you think, what impact, if any, you think this this death is going to have on the immediate future of autonomous vehicles on our streets. But I want to reiterate, there was a driver, a safety driver, a human driver behind the wheel, as far as we know, in Arizona when this woman was struck and killed. I mean, as far as I understand, like, these tests are supposed to have those people behind the wheel, and ostensibly they're supposed to stop the car if the car isn't behaving properly.
Yeah, and look, we know humans are terrible overseers of highly autonomous systems. So yeah. The context of a safety driver in alone is what I believe a necessity right now, but one that is not perfected in any walk of life. So it's to be expected that you're going to see failures in the safety driver as much as you see failures in the automation. But we know from some of the accident reports that California mandates that the technology providers develop that we know the situations where the safety driver has intervened very strategically to help assist the automation. What is the safety driver telling us? The safety driver is telling us that there are bounds of the automation that remain unperfected, uh-huh. that need to be perfected before this technology is ready for prime time.
Where are those bounds right now?
Well, we don't know cohesively okay. because California is one of the few states. Massachusetts has limited reporting requirements, but California is one of the few states that has been requesting reports from the manufacturers of these technologies for some time. And we need greater granularity to that information. And conceptually, one of the hard parts is these companies don't particularly want to share data in this incredibly complex, incredibly competitive framework, nor does the governmental figures that would traditionally be watchdogs have the technological capability to work with that data. So we really need a really new entity, perhaps a public-private entity, much like you're talking about earlier, a new utility for that matter, that has the expertise to work between the manufacturers and the governmental entities to ensure safety and transparency into development of technology that hopefully will change the safety equation that Robin's yeah. talking about here tremendously.
Well, Robin, you've been talking about this for so long, about trying to get policymakers and sort of where we as a public are ahead of the technologists.
Yeah, I was talking with someone today, and they were pointing out to me that if we think about the tech space and big security breaches, there is a well-developed protocol and transparency and expectations, so going back to the word protocol, of exactly who gets told what, how do we share, which type of information, so that these big security breaches that affect the entire one breach in one company impacts the entire industry. And so it's exactly the same parallel here, that we should be sharing safety data, and I don't think that is happening yet. And we really need to make that needs to happen.
Right.
And I think it's important, nor can we expect any of the providers here to, you know, email data to each other. It's too complex to do that. We're talking about petabytes of data.
Yeah.
So there's really need for a middle ground here where there is a trusted entity built. And trust is a real commodity here that's critically important, because it's trust in the transportation system and the mobility space that we need to cultivate. So we need sharing of the scenarios. We need sharing of understanding. But the government doesn't have the technological capability to do this anymore.
So maybe should the industry itself then?
That's why I think it's got to be public-private. You yeah. need governmental involvement, but the industry itself needs to work together to build this new space. You got to build the framework to support autonomy.
I think we'll see that this accident is going to provoke that, because any company that has this accident, and it was Uber, everyone else is going to suffer from that, as we've seen today.
Yeah.
And so they have every incentive to improve that feedback loop around safety, and they should. And the other thing I want to say is that these companies are all separate companies, and they do all have different skill and history and numbers mm-hmm. of miles in which they've done this testing. So they are not all alike, yeah. right? And
Brian, did you want to
I like to yeah. think about this much yeah. as the FDA and pharmacological space. Because the complexities of polypharmacy on the body are beyond any of our knowledge today. We have a lot of good intuition, but at the end of the day, medical imagery doesn't tell us everything about how drugs are impacting the body. Now, This space in Money Senses is a little simpler than that. We can see what's unfolding. But much like the FDA and pharmaceutical trials, when we look at efficacy of technology, we've developed a trusted system in which we prove unknowns, where even two companies working to solve the same, you know, genome problems, cancer problems, et cetera, from very different approaches, are all forced to prove efficacy using a very synergistic model.
Right. So that's the thing. We've come to the point after, you know, decades of having, you know, commonality of reporting requirements, thresholds that companies have to surpass and prove, et cetera. I mean, that's a great analogy. But again, I don't see anyone yet at the federal level saying, well, let's go and try to create the FDA for autonomous vehicles. And it does concern me, and I think it concerns a lot of other people, two of whom are sitting right here, because this is a technology that will transform everything about how we live. So, I mean, how do we get more urgency out there amongst people without more folks having to die, as that poor woman did in Arizona, Robin? I mean, you've been advocating for this. Are people listening?
I have been. It is interesting to me because I feel like when I listen to the policy arguments, there's this kind of sexiness to, everyone wants to have self-driving cars happen in their state, and is it going to bring jobs? And we want to be in the cutting edge of innovation. And that, I think, is what's been driving policymakers in many states and at the federal level, that we want to beat out another country. We want to be on the front edge. We don't want to slow it down. So I think as Peter was saying, it's incredibly complicated. So is there anyone in our government at DOT who's really understanding these issues? And so I just want to present that it is a challenging thing that the industry never wants to be regulated. Hopefully this will be a moment now in which they will come to the table with the federal government. And I think it could be, because before now, it's just been trust us, trust us, trust us. And the U.S. government saying, okay, we're going to keep it pretty wide open. We're going to try this mushy thing back and forth, which I want to say directionally it seems sort of right, because we don't want to make incredibly harsh rules when we don't know what's going on. But we have not had that data. We need to have much more data. And I think it's happening. And I feel like I want to just take that this accident in self-driving cars is the same as accidents that are happening across America today, that we don't actually have very good feedback from the car companies, which are increasingly connected vehicles, to say, hey, you know, we can actually tell you really interesting things about what are happening today with regular drivers, but that data also is not reported back, and that isn't folded in.
Yeah.
I think we got to remember, look, there's many companies out there today who are trying to revolutionize mobility instantaneously. It's going to happen very fast, and it's not. This is an evolution, not a revolution. This technology is going to develop an evolution over time. And we don't want to constrain at this point how we develop this technology for any policy that's non-strategic and long-lasting, because we don't know. There are more unknowns than there are knowns. So as we look forward, how do we, in a world where we like black and white, we need to work together in ways through policy, technology development, advocacy, to set a pathway to safety. So cars that are as safe as we are today probably make sense on the road, but that's not safe enough tomorrow or the next day. So we got to look at the 1.4 million that are killed worldwide and say, that's not acceptable tomorrow.
Right.
What do we do to improve that, and how do we get there? And I don't care what the methods are. I just care that you prove that you're getting there.
Okay. So one last question for you, Brian, from the sort of technology development standpoint. I'm seeing there's a statement here from a Newtonomy spokesperson who's saying that we are working with the city of Boston, with city of Boston officials, to ensure that our automated vehicle pilots continue to adhere to high standards of safety. We have complied with the city's request to temporarily halt autonomous vehicle testing on public roads. So that's sort of the state of play with Newtonomy in Boston. But I have a sort of technological question to ask you to wrap up here. I'm thinking back to the accident a couple of years ago, the crash a couple of years ago with a Tesla that was in autopilot mode. It crashed with a tractor trailer, right? And I think if I remember correctly, it turned out that the Tesla's autopilot couldn't tell the difference between the bright white of the 18-wheeler and the brightness of the sky, that it was having trouble differentiating the two, and that's what caused it. But I guess that's just a little background for the question I want to ask, which is, there's nothing that can fully simulate the randomness and complexity that an autonomous vehicle would has to deal with than an actual city street. I understand that. But is there a step between letting these cars out on the streets now for testing? Is there something between that and like entire closed tracks, which are too simple?
Not really. We really do need the complexity of the real world, but we need to manage the risk in a very open and public framework. You know, the city of Boston and the Newtonomy have developed a very nice pathway in the seaport. Why are they in the seaport? Because it was a reasonable place to start, managing the risks while cultivating the benefits. And it is very much about transparency of risk that we need to understand in making the strategic decisions on where we deploy these technologies, where do we try. Now, that doesn't mean that you go to the simplest of our streets in Arizona. That may be where you do a little bit, but you need a little of the complexity thrown in so you know where the trajectory of the technology needs to move. These are complex AI systems that are very capable of doing a vast majority of what we do as part of the driving task. Mm. But we need to understand over time, over perhaps decades, how to perfect this technology. Yeah.
Well, Brian Reamer, research scientist at MIT's Age Lab and associate director of the New England Transportation Center at MIT, thank you so very much for coming in today. And Robin Chase, co-founder and former CEO of Zipcar and co-founder of Venium, it's always great to have you, Robin. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And folks, send me a tweet at Radio Boston. Let us know what you think about what happened in Arizona with self-driving vehicles and what you think should happen next with them. I'm Megan Trucker-Bright. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Ilan Stavins joins us for the rest of the show today. He's professor of humanities and Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College. He's a man of wide-ranging intellect and interests. I mean, we've previously talked about everything from shamanic hallucinogens to Stavins' Mexican-Jewish heritage to Don Quixote, even our infatuation with selfies. But today, Professor Stavins joins us to talk about something that's dividing us spiritually, symbolically, and literally.
I want to build the wall. We need the wall.
President Trump's wall, of course, the one he wants to build on America's southern border. Ilan Stavins' new book is called The Wall, and it's a poetic exploration of political rhetoric that divides. Professor Stavins, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back.
So I have to ask you, I want to just go back in time a little bit, because as far as I understand it, there's one particular moment in the presidential election that really hit you hardest and made you want to undertake this exploration. It's from October 2016 in the third presidential debate. So let me just listen to a quick moment from that debate.
We're going to get them out. We're going to secure the border. And once the border is secured, at a later date, we'll make a determination as to the rest. But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
And what was it about that particular moment that really struck you?
I have been spending my life studying Spanglish, and I had never heard that expression, bad hombres, the combination of English and Spanish, in a way that was despicable. And it felt like an arrow to my heart, or maybe a knife to my stomach. I felt that here was a candidate that was expressing a divide rather than building a bridge between my country of origin, Mexico, and the country that I chose to come and live in, the United States. And at that moment, Magna, I felt an immediate, almost magnetic force that propelled me to go to that wall that he wanted to build, part of which had already been built by previous administrations, and touch it with my fingers and smell it with my nose and taste the flavors on both sides and hear the people. It felt like that those two words had been brought to me, and that it was my responsibility to make it real for myself, and maybe as a witness, make it real for others.
Well, I was wondering if you could to read a section from the beginning, from near the beginning of the book, that sort of helps us get it into that exploration that you undertook.
This is from the very beginning. Doleful, confine, incision of despair. Margin, precipice, limbo. You slash the body into bulges and punctuate the soul. Shipwrecked in a disconsolate country, in a century built through resentment, for 6 days, y sus noches, I alone, unencumbered, traverse the land like Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca in search of ghosts. The mother whose love for her son has soured. The adopted child in search of genesis. The brother with a heart condition looking for a doctor to cure him. I am an abstraction. My imagination, free, scans the emotional landscape. Places are sites where fantasy meets recognition. Reality is such an aberration, it is okay to go crazy.
Well, that's Ilan Stavins reading from his new book, The Wall. I wonder if you could just... So, first of all, why did you want to share sort of your explorations through this poetic medium?
I had been a Magna translator of mostly Latin American, that is Spanish-speaking, some indigenous, Hebrew and Yiddish poets. I had always taken the back seat, so to speak, although I don't think of translators as disappearing. I think of translators as enabling. But at this point, when traveling to the U.S.-Mexican border, I felt that I wanted to use the poetry that I had learned by bringing it from other languages into English and turn it into my own voice, delivering it in a way that could serve as an instrument of investigation. I wanted to create something that resembled that delightful American book called The Spoon River Anthology, where multiple voices coalesce, and one gets the impression that all of them really belong to a voice of voices. And those voices are contradictory, and they love and hate each other. And ultimately, by listening to all of them, you get a feeling that reality is much more complex than we often hear or we often read, and that in the dissonance, in the contradictions, is where we find the beauty of being alive.
Mm. You know, so this particular wall that President Trump wants to build, of course, it is. If it goes up, it would be literally divisive. But its greater power is its political and spiritual divisiveness, right? I mean, that's why it strikes us all so deeply, whether positively or negatively, every time he talks about it, which is virtually every day.
Right.
But, you know, the president also says something else, which I'd love to hear your thoughts on. I mean, he says, if you don't have borders, you don't have a country. And you know, like, to him, the wall is the symbol of protection of country.
The wall is the edge. The wall is the limit. And every individual, every family, every group, every community, every nation needs to understand its own limits. If we don't have limits, we don't know who we are. If we don't see others outside those limits, we can't recognize how we behave, what the heritage that we have inherited, in what way it shapes us. But we don't have to turn our borders into belligerent zones. We don't have to cut bridges. Borders are not about diminishing who is on the other side, about tarnishing their vision or silencing their voices. Borders are about establishing where I end and where you begin. And I want to see you next to me. I want to feel you. And I want to know that you are just on the other side, just as I am on the other side for you. And that, I think, is crucial. We don't have to be building borders in order to elevate nations. We have to build borders in order to define nations. That is crucial.
Mm. Well, Ilan Stavins is a professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College. His new book is called The Wall. We've got more information about it at radioboston.org. Professor Stavins, you're a person I could talk with for hours. Promise that you'll come back again.
I promise. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.